Not often.
All right. Well, from planes and trains and automobiles to horses and bikes and even boats, yes, no mode of transportation escapes the award-winning For the People when it has an opportunity to do good. And I'm here with the three seagoing do-gooders right now on the deck of the Black Mariah here in West Haven. And so pleased to make the acquaintance of Veteran Angler Charters, a nonprofit 501c3 organization that serves veterans. If you'd like to follow along while we chat, you can go to veterananglercharters.org. That's their website to learn about them, because they provide free charter fishing trips to wounded and recovering veterans. And our listeners know that the award-winning For the People is very, very interested in promoting organizations like this who provide some support and relief and do some magic with these veterans. And I've got some here with me today. As a matter of fact, I made the acquaintance of Cliff Potter, a Vietnam veteran who went on to the Army and Air Force National Guard, 33-plus years in service. Thank you, Cliff. I'm told by our other guest on the boat with me, her boat, Captain Kathy Granfield, who was the founder of Veteran Angler Charters, that she was actually pitching the idea of putting this thing together with Cliff at one point. So let me start with you, Kathy. Tell us a little bit more about that nugget of an idea and how it's grown into something that is a multi-state effort and involves dozens of folks just like you who own boats and care about vets.
Well, I got the idea originally, but I think it was either 06 or 07. It was the first year that more servicemen and women had actually come home from combat and taken their own lives. And that that really hit me. I just thought, oh, my God, like that can't keep going on. Somebody has to do something. But I'm thinking, you know, I'm a teacher. What am I going to do? I had no idea what I could do to help. And I was out on a fishing trip with Cliff, actually, and I was thinking what a nice time we're having out here, and I just thought, Cliff, you know, I have an idea. What do you think about taking veterans who are, you know, newly home from combat, maybe taking them out fishing? Not that fishing is the solution to everything, although if you're raised in my family, they do believe that fishing is the solution to all life's problems. But I just knew that for myself, when I'm feeling really badly, a day out in the water really does help. Yeah. And I knew there was nothing I could do about some of the psychic and physical baggage they were carrying, but what I could do was provide a quiet place where they could be with other vets who really understood their service experience and get away from the shore. And have nothing really there except, like, the water and the wind and the fishing. And I thought maybe that would help. So that's sort of what precipitated the whole thing.
Okay. So, Cliff, you've been out on a few of these journeys, and we've heard from so many other folks that work with veterans that it's challenging sometimes to get them in the same place at the same time, and then yet another hurdle to kind of get them interacting. But once they do, magic happens. And I'm sure when you're kind of, as Kathy said, out there on the quiet of the water, and there's the distraction of fishing, it really makes a difference. Tell us a little bit about some of the things that you've seen while you've been kind of shadowing these trips.
Well, what it is you raise their comfort level, and the buffer of the water compared to the clinical settings that they might be used to for getting their help, the water has such a different effect on them. And I like to use the term, they have baggage when they come down that ramp. They set that baggage on the ramp. They go out, fish, relax, make new friends, talk back and forth. It opens up some of the hard-to-reach places where PTSD affects them. And when they come back, they still might pick up that luggage and carry it back to wherever they're living or residing. Yeah. But it might not be quite as heavy as it was when they left it on the dock. More can be accomplished on that water in 1 or 2 hours than can be tried to be accomplished, the same thing in a laboratory setting.
Sure.
And so it does affect them differently, but in a positive way. You know, it takes a lot of the negative off of it. Mm-hmm. You know, and PTSD is not like, well, you broke your arm, it's going to heal in 3 weeks. PTSD has no set healing date for everybody. Mm. I mean, it's thank God the government's understanding it, but who knows if they're treating it properly.
Yeah. Well, in terms of the experience, do you feel, based on all that you've seen on these trips, that Kathy is actually inadvertently working toward her goal of trying to reduce the depression, the anxiety, or anything else that might enter into their mind frame and cause them to maybe not want to be around anymore?
We have, and with Kathy's permission, is it okay if I bring up what you told me about 3 weeks ago?
Oh, yeah, sure.
We have positive proof. Oh. She took a gentleman out last year, I believe it was, and correct me. Last October, she took a gentleman out. He was kind of quiet, but he fished, and I believe he even gave you a donation at that time.
Yeah, he sent me a beautiful thank you letter and gave a donation for the program, which is unusual and really wonderful.
Okay.
Then this spring, you ran into him someplace else. And he revealed to her that if he hadn't gone out that day with her, the next day he would have probably taken his life.
Mm.
So she's on suicide prevention, whether she knows it or not. That's the one she knows about. You have to question how many other lives has she saved, but she doesn't know about. And suicide and PTSD are so still rampant. I mean, everybody wants to cover them up and pretend they're not there. Yeah. But if you look at the records, how many military people are committing suicide, and how many people are suffering from PTSD? I mean, you just can't stop. You can't cover it up. You have to address it somehow. And this woman is able to do that and provide a service that you're not. You can't even put a price on it. How do you put a price on how quick somebody's going to, you know, or take their life or not take their life? So it's invaluable service.
That's suicide prevention with a hook, line, and sinker, huh?
That was clever.
New catchphrase. You can have it.
Okay, thank you very much.
No, actually, fishing with a mission is the slogan of veteran angler charters. And folks, if you're just tuning in, we're here on the Black Mariah in West Haven, a beautiful fishing boat and cruiser with Captain Kathy Granfield. We're also joined by Captain Thomas Bremer, who reached out to us, and thank you for doing that, Tom. Tell us a little bit. Now, you're relatively new to the organization, but you kind of have a special charge, duty, if you will, to this organization. Tell us about what you do.
Yes, John, thank you. I am fairly new to the organization. I've been here for a few months. I actually met Kathy at a fishing show in Rhode Island. I was absolutely blown away by the purpose of the organization as well as the dedication of the individuals. I've come on to try to help raise awareness of the program amongst our donors as well as the veterans that we serve. What sets Veteran Angler Charters kind of apart from the other organizations that I've been involved with is that we are solely donor-based. Donations of kind individuals that care about our veterans is what allows us to operate, and no individuals in our organization take a paycheck. 100% of the funds that are provided go to the directly to serving our veterans. So we certainly appreciate the opportunity today to talk with you about this. Reputable organization such as yourself is a great way of us getting the word out there. We are fairly small. We run 3 charter boats currently in 3 separate states, but the more support that we get, the more veterans we can help each year.
Mm-hmm. And aside from here in West Haven, where else are these charters based?
We have a boat in Rhode Island and a boat in Massachusetts as well.
Excellent. Well, I got to tell you, I mean, from a broadcasting perspective, it's such a horrid challenge to have to come down here on a beautiful sunny day and stand on a boat and talk to you folks about saving veterans' lives. Let me tell you, this is what really makes it all worthwhile. So Kathy, tell us a little bit more about how you attract the individuals who you take out on at least the trips here on your boat, and a little bit about how maybe other folks that have boats like this might be able to get involved.
When I started, honestly, there was definitely a credibility issue because I was a civilian, and I was cold calling vet centers, just letting them know that we were available to do this work. And it took almost 2 years, actually, from the conception of the idea until we took our first trip. Our first trip was in July of 2009 with the New Haven Vet Center.
Mm-hmm.
And it really snowballed after that. The guys had a great time, and they went back to the vet center and told their buddies about it. And we went from six trips a year to almost 40 at this point.
Okay.
And I was by myself for the first 5 years. And then I realized there's no way I could by myself kind of keep up with the demand. So I recruited first Captain Mark Pettit out of Massachusetts. He fishes out of Plymouth. And 2 years after that, I recruited Randy Bagwell out of Bristol, Rhode Island. So between the three of us, we start fishing usually in early May. The Rhode Island boat and the Massachusetts boat usually stop the end of September, beginning of October, and I go a little bit longer. I fish usually through Halloween down here in Connecticut.
Okay.
And we do strictly use licensed charter boats with licensed charter captains. I'm the exception. I'm a civilian, but Randy and Mark are both Navy veterans. And the reason that we just use licensed charter captains is because the extra level of, like, safety and security. You know somebody's got a charter license, who's running a regular charter business, has got all the safety equipment that they need, they've got all the insurance that they need, they've got medical training, and in the case of our Massachusetts captain, he is actually an EMT, as well as a fireman. So we do our very best to make sure that when the veterans get on the boat, they don't have to worry about anything. They don't have to worry about the captain's qualifications. They don't have to worry about the boat. All our boats are U.S. Coast Guard inspected. So it's just one more layer that they can let go. You know?
And from how far afield of either Plymouth, Rhode Island, or West Haven do you draw the veterans who have come out on these veteran angler charters?
We're drawing primarily from the New England area, obviously. We have had requests from as far away as Texas and California, and I don't have boats there yet. Maybe someday. At this point, we did have someone travel from Pennsylvania, drive all night to come take a trip with us, which was, I just thought that was crazy myself. But, drawing primarily from like 90 miles from each boat, essentially, right now.
And if there's a veteran or a family of a veteran who's listening to the program or hears about the program this morning, can they just go on the website and reach you individually, or do they have to be sort of qualified or funneled through a veteran's fraternal or, even a federal organization to be kind of hooked up with you guys?
When I started, I worked basically through veteran service organizations of pretty much any kind, for a number of reasons. One was we needed to verify that they had a service-connected disability or injury or condition. And I also wanted to have someone on the boat who was either a peer support counselor or a caregiver. So initially when we started, we just worked with groups. But now we do get individual requests from people. So if an individual's out there and they're listening and they're interested in a trip, if they just go to the website and click on the link and send me an email, what we often do is we'll have a trip, say, for example, with the New Haven Vet Center or the Hartford Vet Center, and instead of having five guys come, I'll have three, and then I'll add two individuals who've contacted me privately. So we do take between five and six individuals every trip.
And did I hear you right? You often or always are accompanied by a clinician?
Often. If we come with a group, we're always accompanied by a clinician. If it's what's called an open boat trip where people approach me privately, I do have a group of clinicians who are on standby. And if this is where it gets a little bit awkward for me. I don't want to invade anybody's privacy with respect to their medical condition.
Sure.
But I do need to know if they need mobility help or if they should have... Or if you need a clinician on board, basically.
Sure. Yeah.
If someone approaches me privately, I will ask them, you know, if they have any special needs that I need to be aware of. And if that's the case, I do have sort of a laundry list of folks I can call and make sure that we've got somebody on board.
Okay. So how would you like folks listening to the program who may be moved by your philanthropy and want to help support one of these charters or perhaps one of the 40 that you do every year, maybe turn it into 50 or 60 across the network? Or if someone needs to reach out to you because they know a vet they think might be able to experience that potentially life-saving trip out with you on the boat?
The easiest way, honestly, is through the website. If they're on social media, we also have two Facebook pages. One is public and one is a group. They can just ask to join the group. And once they're online, they can just contact me directly that way. It's probably the easiest.
And how about folks who may not be able to write a check and make a donation? Are there any other kinds of volunteer jobs or anything else that folks who either know boats or who may just want to help can do?
I get an awful lot of requests from captains who want to work with us, and unfortunately, we just don't have the funds right now. To do the 40 trips costs us about $30,000 for the year. Okay. So I have to raise, when a new captain comes on the one hand, it's that many more veterans that we can provide our service to, but then I have to raise another $6,000 or $7,000 in order for that to happen. So right now, we're sort of topped out at three. We're looking at a fourth captain right now. But our biggest need for volunteers is sort of like what Tom is doing for us, just helping us sort of spread the word about the organization. Helping with fundraising is huge because we don't have any corporate sponsorship at this point, so we're relying really heavily on individual donations. Actually, exclusively, pretty much. except for my students. They run a fabulous dodgeball tournament every year that raises a couple thousand dollars for our program. My students have been awesome.
And you teach where?
In North Brantford at the intermediate school.
All right. Very good. Well, from teacher to boat captain to philanthropist to the life-saving idea that has become Veteran Angler Charters, Kathy Granfield and her cohorts on board the Black Mariah today in West Haven, Cliff Potter, Vietnam vet and Army and Air Guard Reserve.
National Guard
service, 33 plus years in service. Cliff, thank you for being on the program and for your service, sir. Captain Thomas Bremer, who did the outreach to introduce us, and I'm sure we'll be coming back again, not just because we like boats and beautiful weather, but we really love folks who kind of start a grassroots idea, and you've heard from the program what it's turned into. We hope you'll reach out to them and help. Captain Kathy Granfield, founder, thank you for having us on board and for your work as well. Go to veteranangler.com/charters.org to learn more. It's a 501c3 nonprofit organization, so any contributions you may make will be fully tax deductible. Or if you'd like to do more, or you are a licensed charter captain, you may want to reach out and see if they can't help you help our veterans here. Thank you, folks, for having us on board. Well, the great thing about doing a radio program like this for so long is you make these friendships. And if my guest on the program this morning, who has been with us year after year and oftentimes parachutes in for special segments during the year in between annual reports to the state and to our listeners, if Carl Wagner walked up to me in the grocery store and kicked me in the shins, I wouldn't know who he was because we reacquaint a couple of times a year on the phone and through this program, but we have never met. So I'm going to make it my goal for 2017, Carl, to get up to the office or rendezvous somewhere with you so we can get face to face. But in the meantime, you're joining us again as the executive director of Connecticut's Council on Environmental Quality, which has been serving and caring for Connecticut's environment since 1971. They assess the condition of Connecticut's environment and report findings annually to the governor and recommend actions to improve state environmental programs. They also advise other state agencies on environmental impacts of proposed construction projects and other capital projects, and they also investigate citizens' complaints and allegations of violations of environmental laws. So, Carl, you know, we've entered interesting times here. You might say the influence in Washington is pervasive across our country, and that has led to some changes in behavior in some cases. I as we record the program today, I'm not even sure yet if President Trump has pulled us out of the Paris Climate Initiative or not. At this point when we're recording, but here in Connecticut, since your organization looks into and investigates environmental complaints, before we talk about the report, could you give us a little bit of an orientation onto the kinds of things that that people are doing to harm Connecticut's environment based on the complaints that you've gotten over the past year?
Well, I can, We had a busy year, and some of the complaints are things I think you would just call routine, such as some people can call us if they see some suspicious activity, like some smoke coming out of a building on a regular basis that didn't used to be there. Now, if people do see a pollution problem, they should call the much larger Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, and they have most of the field staff. But if they've already called them, or they see an unusual situation, and it doesn't seem to fit into anybody's, jurisdiction, they can call us. And we had some really interesting ones in 2016 that weren't necessarily violations, but some people, I'll just give you a couple examples here. In fact, they involve government agencies more than anyone. That people expressed alarm to us, and I think we talked about this, that a lot of the solar energy facilities
were being built on
forest and farmland instead of going on to industrial lands and rooftops and places where they belong. We'd actually looked into that and agreed, and we identified the reasons for that, and have put out a special report. We recommended some legislation to change the procedures so that these solar facilities, which we all want, end up in the right places. And another really interesting one is some people came to us, including representatives of some of the Native American tribes, and pointed out that there are a lot of Native American archaeological and sacred sites on state land, on state park and state forest land, and the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection is responsible for that and for protecting those sites, but it doesn't have any plan to do that. It's required by law to have a plan, but it doesn't. And there are many of such sites on state land. So we have brought this to the attention of the department, and hopefully there will be a plan produced so that these really interesting sites get the protection they deserve and that they're entitled to. So those are a couple of examples that involve some rather in-depth research from our office.
Oh, okay. So basically, if somebody sees somebody like pouring gasoline or motor oil down a catch basin, they should either call the police or the DEEP.
Yes.
But these are a little bit more high level issues that you've been talking about that sometimes I would imagine or may typically involve, as you said, in the case of the solar sprawl in forests and on open spaces. There are a number of environmental groups that backed that complaint with the potential degradation or risk to sacred Native American sites. It was the tribal representatives that brought this concern to you, but certainly average citizens can contact your organization. And if you want to read, we may actually rebroadcast the solar sprawl segment at some point in the next few weeks. But
great.
If folks want to read that, it's ct.gov/CEQ, which is the clearinghouse splash page for all of the reports and information for the Council on Environmental Quality. But what brings us around again to talk to Carl is the annual release of their state report. And despite everything that the council is doing and the state is doing to improve air and water, we are apparently not on track. And the report identifies what they're calling three headwinds and a possible fourth that impede Connecticut's progress. So, Carl, let's drill into these, starting with climate.
Mm-hmm.
Seems appropriate as we wait for news out of Washington today.
I know.
And Connecticut
it
is such
a bit
leader.
Discouraging because, as you said, the Connecticut does a lot and more than its share in some when compared to some other states to reduce air pollution, and not just the state government but individual citizens. I mean, you buy a car; it's in Connecticut. It's probably very low pollution. We have the inspection program and so forth and so on. We do a lot in the state to reduce pollution, but the number of bad air days is remarkably stubborn. I mean, the number of bad air days in 2016 was 31, and the 10-year average was 32. So it's a bit discouraging because we as a state, we take all of these actions to reduce air pollution, but we still have all these bad air days, and a lot of that is due to the fact that the temperature is warming. Summertime temperatures are going up. Last year was particularly warm, and that translates into more air pollution, ground level ozone in particular in the air, and that's the worst one.
Well, I was going to ask you, it's not even really about putting a big bubble over the state because other states aren't being respectful. I know probably going back 10 years or so when Connecticut really worked hard to create solidarity with its surrounding states over emissions to try to keep the air cleaner and more healthy around the tri-state area and up and through New England, you know, that was a big thing. And it was kind of a David and Goliath thing because there were other states further afield that did not respect the emissions standards and practices that Connecticut and its consortium had, and we were still getting bad air. But now we're even transcending pollutants and other environmental issues that are floating up into Connecticut's airspace from points elsewhere. This is a global issue.
It is global. I mean, especially if you're talking about global climate change, yes, that's a global issue. And the coal-burning plants and so forth are huge sources of that. Last year, transportation became a bigger source of those emissions than power plants nationwide. And that's something of a turning point. But yeah, I mean, as you say, the New England states, the northeastern states, are pretty good with regard to emissions from power plants. And in fact, we're very good. And you go to Pennsylvania and Ohio and points west, and they burn a lot of coal, and we unfortunately get the emissions. So until they clean up, do their share, we're going to suffer. There's no question about it. And with the warming temperatures, it's just discouraging. That's about all I can tell you on that.
Yeah.
And another, you know, similarly, Long Island Sound did not have a good year. There were more areas of the sound with hypoxia. That's when there's not enough oxygen in the water. And it was one of the worst years in several, and again, probably because of the rising temperatures.
Okay. Folks, if you're just joining us, we're talking with Carl Wagoner. He's a great asset and resource to our program going back many, many years. He's executive director for Connecticut's Council on Environmental Quality. CT.gov/CEQ is their website if you'd like to read a little more in depth about the things that we're talking about on the air today. And we're going to come back in the second half of our interview to talk about several other points that are made in the annual report that CEQ produces for the governor. We're going to talk about non-point source pollution and permanent pavement conservation investments or lack of them, as well as revisiting issues with Long Island Sound to wrap things up. Carl, stick with us. Folks, stick with us. We'll be back right after this break. Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's John Vocat, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning in to the award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, this morning we're heading to the harbor to introduce Connecticut to Veteran Angler Charters, a nonprofit organization providing free charter fishing trips to wounded and recovering veterans. We're going to learn how this grassroots service organization provides small group experiences for veterans aboard private charter boats out of West Haven, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts, often resulting in an improved mood, significant pain reduction, and reduced stress levels among veterans following their trip. Then we're going to catch up with the Connecticut Council on Environmental Quality to hear how issues in Washington could have significant and negative impact right here in our state. We'll review the CEQ's annual report to the state legislature and key in on a few concerns and successes the state has experienced in the past year, environmentally speaking. And we'll close with another incredible grassroots nonprofit called EARS. That stands for Emergency Animal Response Service, providing free emergency medical and trauma response across the state just for your beloved pets. We'll chat with some of the EARS responders and share how you can benefit from or help support this group when pet owners find themselves in traumatic situations with their furry, feathered, and other beloved pets. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vocat, right after this reminder. You can start your Independence Day weekend off right by giving the gift of life, because the Connecticut Epilepsy Advocate is welcoming eligible blood donors to help save lives this summer by attending the group's first annual Summer Mega Blood Drive. It's coming up on Monday, July 3rd from 10 to 6:30 at St. Agnes Church on Merwin Avenue in Milford. The Connecticut Epilepsy Advocate is committed to raising awareness about the need for blood, especially during the summer months, and is recommending potential donors who are coming to this drive to make it easy by registering in advance. Just visit redcrossblood.org and mention the Connecticut Epilepsy Advocates Summer Mega Blood Drive. Once again, just go to redcrossblood.org. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click onto Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Vocat. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. The harmful effects of smoking on health and well-being are well known. However, despite alarming statistics, the number of smokers still continues to climb. In an effort to help Connecticut residents kick their tobacco habit once and for all, the Connecticut Department of Public Health is launching a new cessation program called Commit to Quit. Because quitting tobacco is not a one-size-fits-all experience, the Commit to Quit program provides personalization through experienced quit coaches who will help program participants figure out the right quit path for themselves. There's also face-to-face cessation programs available. If you'd like more information, just visit CommitToQuitCT.com. That's CommitToQuitCT.com. Well, we're back. Thanks for sticking with us. You must love the planet like we do. Carl Wagoner is on the line. He's Executive Director for Connecticut's Council on Environmental Quality, and we're drilling into the 2016 report that the council has developed for the governor. So, Carl, let's pick it up with permanent pavement. That also has to be taking its toll on waterways and the Sound.
It is, and it's another reason that our environment doesn't change all that much. I mean, so much of the pollution that goes into Long Island Sound and into our streams and rivers comes from runoff that flows off the land after a rainfall, off of pavement, off of lawns, off of agricultural fields. So much of our pollution comes into the water from these sources, and Connecticut's, you know, land use patterns have been set for decades. So we have what we call permanent pavement. I mean, we're not going to be able to fix this problem in a short period of time. There are things the state is doing. Certainly towns and cities are taking steps to reduce this pollution. Homeowners can take steps to reduce it. These things help. But even as we, you know, reduce the nitrogen and raw sewage that comes out of sewage treatment plants, we still have these other problems, and they're due to this, permanent pavement. So it's going to take a long time to really get the water quality to where it'll meet the state's goals. And we have goals, and we're not there, and it's going to be a while.
Yeah, and as you said before the break, you know, this is also contributing to the health of the ecosystem in Long Island Sound. And
oh, yeah.
So when you take the runoff that is in some respects or to some degree poisoning our water tables, our watersheds, our waterways, and Long Island Sound, you know, you've got kind of a poison coming downstream into the Sound, and the effects of global warming with the adequate oxygen levels reduced down to about 81%, as you mentioned earlier, the second worst in 10 years. even as cities and towns are working to discharge less pollutants into the Sound. So Long Island Sound is really taking a beating, and it seems like the ways to control and improve the situation on the Sound are either far out of reach or seemingly impossible to get our arms around as a state.
I don't know about impossible, but you know, it's a long-term
daunting
effort.
Daunting, then.
Yeah, daunting it is. It's a challenge. Towns and cities have new responsibilities this year for trying to reduce the amount of pollution that washes off, so at least the runoff will be cleaner when it hits the water and gets into Long Island Sound. So, you know, the situation can improve, but it will take a long time.
And it seems like we probably have to work a lot harder from the input end to offset much of what we can't control in terms of the warming factor.
That's exactly right.
So it's just going to take even more work and awareness, and that's the good thing about the Council on Environmental Quality, because folks can come to your agency's website or to your agency, view the reports, learn the little things that they can do, because a few people could do big things, but it's going to take a lot of people doing little things that are going to make all the difference in the world. In the last 5 minutes or so that we have with you, let's return to another issue that comes up cyclically between us as we chat about these reports every year, Carl, and that is the state's investment in land and wildlife. I hearken back, 5, 6, 7 years ago, public land, we were at adding to the stock of public land, public forests. We were, regaling some of the conservation efforts and the expansion of acquisition of land, and now we see the worm has turned.
Is it a worm? There was a time, not all that long ago, when the state was on track to meet its land conservation goals, as you suggest, but in the last few years, the state itself is hardly acquiring any land at all, about less than 600 acres in 2016, and that is never going to get the state toward the goals it's set for itself. The state has a plan called the Green Plan. It lays out how many acres we're supposed to have, and the conservation of land is essential to conserve wildlife. And we track in our report a variety of wildlife, turtles, grouse, bats, other species of wildlife, forest birds, and none of them are doing well. And the foundation of that is to conserve land and to conserve it in large tracts of land where the wildlife lives. And we're not getting that job done. I mean, you can't slice the data any other way. We're just not doing it.
And some of that has to do, if I see correctly from the report here, what you're calling mosaic habitats, which is the lack of continuity in these forests and open spaces?
Well, the mosaic habitats is a new term we're using. We didn't make it up, but we introduced it into our report this year. The mosaic habitats is a good thing. We don't want to confuse that with fragmented habitats.
Oh, okay.
What we're worried about is fragmentation of the habitat. You put a road in through a forest or through a field, and the habitat is much less valuable to the wildlife now, especially if houses follow and lawns and mini malls or whatever. Mm. And by mosaic habitat, we mean like a combination of forests and meadows and wetlands and streams all together and not broken up, not fragmented. So it's a mosaic of high-quality habitat, and that's what's really lacking. So many species of wildlife need that combination of habitat, and we don't have enough of that anymore. So that's so turtles and things like that, like to have to be able to move back and forth from the water to the forest to the field, and they can't do that.
Okay. Well, as we draw to a close on another conversation about the annual report, we'll once again remind people they can go to ct.gov/CEQ for the Council on Environmental Quality. And sort of the last word on the advance that you've referred me to, Carl, is this fourth headwind, which is Washington, D.C. As we said, you know, we're going to be broadcasting this down the road a week or so. But as we're talking, we're poised to hear the outcome of the president's decision on the Paris Agreement. So I guess aside from everybody in the sound of our voices going to the CEQ website and learning how they can make a difference in their own yard, their own neighborhoods, their own communities, everybody in the state of Connecticut needs to be paying attention and be a little more active in their responses to Washington, D.C. over environmental issues.
Well said. I mean, things could get worse. You know, we're focused. We have been focused on how to make things better, but you have to be alert to the fact that things could get worse.
Very good. Established in 1971, the Council on Environmental Quality submits Connecticut's annual report on the status of the environment to the governor pursuant to Connecticut general statutes. Additional responsibilities, as you've heard, include the review of construction projects of other state agencies, a publication of their environmental monitor, investigation of citizens' complaints and allegations of violations of environmental laws. Once again, you can learn all about them at ct.gov/CEQ. Carl Wagner, the council's director, is a great resource and good friend to the award-winning For the People, and we look forward to talking with you again soon, Carl. Be well.
All right. Well, when I had the occasion to call for help from EARS, the Emergency Animal Response Service, unfortunately, in my case, it was too late to tap their services, but they were kind enough to offer to come out and help at no charge. EARS is a nonprofit animal emergency team serving all of Connecticut at no cost to its patients or owners. And we're so pleased to join a threesome of representatives from EARS today. We're going to start with John Nowinski, who is the founder of the organization. John, thanks for having us up here today. We should tell people we're meeting you today as you're staked out at Griffin Hospital in Derby. And is this something that you guys do? You go out to various places to kind of build awareness?
Yeah, exactly. Especially this time of year with it being summertime and hot and people are out traveling with their animals. We do a lot of these community events to not only raise awareness of our services should anybody ever need us, but also give some advice on things to do for the summertime to make sure that pets are safe. And also just in general, if you have a pet emergency, you know, what do you do? There's a lot of questions. Obviously, they don't always happen when timing is right, things like that. So just to make people aware that we're there if they need us, whether it be providing resources to a local veterinary or emergency clinic that's in their area, or whether it is something that they need help with an animal where a member of our team will actually come out 24/7 and assist them with that.
Excellent. Let's do a little backstory. Tell us about yourself and how this whole idea came to light.
Well, I've been around animals my entire life. I'm one of those people that have never been without one. I'm also one of those people who've been in situations where I've had an animal that needed to get into a vet and I didn't have a car or I didn't quite know what to do. Thankfully, you know, I was able to get through those. But basically, EARS started during Hurricane Sandy. I was doing some volunteer work with a couple local volunteer fire departments as well as a rescue farm that's actually up in Bethany, Connecticut. And when areas of Milford and Stratford and Orange began to get evacuation orders, the fire departments actually started to get people with pets that needed assistance. And they started to reach out to me knowing that I was working with animals in some capacity. And we kind of pulled together a very small group of people to go out and help the individuals with pets get out of those areas. And as that grew, I realized that there was really a need for that. basically, you know, not only in the evacuation aspect, but then also in the aspect of medical emergency. Not everybody is able to get their own pets up, and not everybody, you know, feels comfortable doing it. They're worried about further injury to their animal. And sometimes, you know, we just have large animals, large pets, too. You know, you can have an 80-pound dog that under normal circumstances goes outside, jumps in the car, and it's fine. But, you know, if that dog's unable to help itself, that's a lot of weight to try to move yourself.
Sure.
And
sure.
Not everybody can do it, which is totally understandable.
At what point in the history post-Hurricane Sandy did you add the actual vehicle to give you sort of like a rolling triage center to transport the animals?
Well, that's a really good question. Basically, I started working with VCA Shoreline Emergency Animal Hospital in Shelton. I started there as a veterinary assistant, and now I'm an emergency specialist. So we see a lot of situations that come in where owners would call our hospital and need assistance getting into the hospital. And unfortunately, from the veterinary standpoint, there's a lot that can be done in hospital, but most vet clinics don't have the ability to go out and assist an owner to come in. So it used to be, you know, our suggestions were to try to get a friend or get a neighbor. And basically that I saw that need, and thankfully, we haven't had a huge need for the disaster aspects. So even though we're fully trained in that and ready to do that, we started adding the ability of responding to medical emergencies. We do a lot of that with the volunteer fire departments around here because they know that we're trained in emergency response. So we do things like supporting them on site with oxygen for pets, with basic first aid and triage for pets, basically taking the animal aspect from them so that they can focus on the human aspect or the fire in those situations. Mm-hmm. We were lucky enough to get this ambulance a year and a half ago. It was actually, we raised the money to do it. It is a human ambulance that we have now modified and retrofitted for animal use. The amazing thing is, one of the things we love doing here at places like this hospital, like Griffin Hospital, is that even EMTs and nurses here know what an ambulance is obviously like. So they're very surprised when they see the capability we have, because it's very akin to what a human ambulance would carry.
Yeah, sure.
We do have oxygen on board for animals. We have first aid supplies. We have stretchers, we have medical bags, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is basically the level of care for people, for animals. And some people would say it's sometimes a little even better than that.
Yeah. Well, I guess for my last question before we meet Bree and the other John is... obviously, we're going to talk to John Santori, who's not just a responder, but kind of an exotics expert, and he's here today with a snake. And I guess you go down to the pet mice and gerbils and reptiles and parakeets and things like that. How big do you go? I mean, do you guys go to like horses and larger animals, even if it's not involving transports, but immediate care on site?
We do. People are very surprised. We actually do everything from small animals, basically, you know, the sort of pocket pets, like rabbits and things like that, all the way up to horses. Obviously not in the rig itself, but we actually do use the rig as a basis for operations like that. We have a closet on the outside of the ambulance, which is completely filled with large animal gear. So we actually do carry halters, lead ropes. We also carry lifting straps and pole straps in case a horse does go down and need assistance with that. So we actually do carry large animal equipment on this ambulance as well. We do have a hitch on the ambulance, which if need be, we can pull a trailer. So we are actually perfectly capable of sort of expanding the base of the ambulance. The other thing about the ambulance is that we do carry in what would normally be the outside stretcher or backboard closet. We carry a pop-up tent. And we also carry tables. So we're actually capable of not only operating within the ambulance, but sort of expanding that footprint.
Wow.
Should we need a larger aspect, like having multiple animals involved with a triage or something like that.
Excellent. We're speaking with John Nowinski. He's the founder of EARS, the Emergency Animal Response Service, available 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and it all comes at no cost. Of course, they would welcome your contributions. They are a nonprofit nonprofit animal emergency team serving all of Connecticut. EARSCT.org is their website if you'd like to learn more, or you can give them a call in Connecticut. Their emergency number, if need be, is 203-247-0310. So Bree is inside, so we'll come and meet this fine gentleman, John Santori, who has an equally wonderful special guest this morning, which is, and I made the mistake of calling it a garter snake, and I saw it got a little mad at me. John Santori, great to meet you. What do we have here in your wrapped around your hands and arms?
We have a Mexican black king snake.
And was this one that was donated by someone who thought it was a good idea at some point to acquire it?
Oh no, this was came from my friend Frank. He couldn't keep it because he had a cat and the cat wouldn't leave it alone. And he already had a bearded dragon, so like, you know, I'll just give this to someone. And he gave it to me. And I've had him for a couple of years now.
Oh, okay. Well, tell us, for all of the folks that might be listening who either themselves own what you would classify as exotic animals or those out there who may be considering getting one, are there a few specific things that you like to advise people when it comes to this class of pet?
I do. Bearded dragons are the main thing that people like to get as exotic animals, and they are, they're not difficult to take care of, but they do get bigger than most people realize. Kind of like most snakes, mm-hmm. and they're considered exotic. Geckos, amphibians of all kinds. So, come here, buddy. So I advise people whenever they ask me if they want to get these things, I tell them exactly what they're in for, the temperature requirements, the feeding requirements, and anything else they have questions for.
Is there a typical handful of exotic animals that are so prolific in the Connecticut area that you're getting more of a preponderance of calls to respond for assistance to them?
We don't get a lot of calls for exotics. If we were, it'd be more for the bigger animals that people don't like to handle or it's difficult for them to get. Right. Like iguanas are bigger, they get really big. Bearded dragons, not so much. Something called an Argentine tegu, which gets kind of big. It's kind of like a small dog.
Oh, okay. Very good. Well, we thank you for taking a few minutes with us and introducing us to your maybe forever friend or your current pet.
20 years.
Oh, okay. So he'll be around to see you grow older.
Yeah.
Great. Bree, let's bring you in real quick. Bree Oleander is a primary responding technician. And Bree, what I wanted to go to you for, and thanks for taking a few minutes to talk with us, is if you could, as I have experienced recently in my call to your office, to your agency, I should say, you know, you're in that white hot moment where your typical pets, the dog or the cat, may have either gotten hit by a car or suddenly starts screaming or are in obvious distress. The owner is trying to help, or maybe even, as I heard a couple of days ago, the cat came back kind of horribly mauled and wet with Lord knows what. Can you give the folks who are listening some advice that they may be able to call upon if they come upon or are called by their pet because that pet is experiencing some sort of trauma?
Yes. So a lot of times that we do calls, it's the dog has either had some issues, has been hit, or has a lot of trauma. And the owner, for me, because I have my own dogs, it's so stressful. It is very emotional. But the dog is there and needs to be calm. In order for any types of treatment, for us to check them out, for anything to happen, we need to make sure the dog's calm. And the only way they can do that is by listening to our voices and understand that if we're calm, they'll be calm. And know a lot of the times that we do transports, it is bringing them to the Rainbow Bridge. And as long as they know that the ride is safe, they're going for a ride, they're enjoying themselves, they'll know that always and forever, they'll have that special treatment. The dogs, in my heart, it's really hard to remove yourself as an owner. It is significantly difficult, especially putting yourself in seeing a dog that's been lying there for hours or a dog that's been in just so much trauma. They need that calm, relaxed. And I never realized that I actually had that natural instinct is being very calm in those types of situations. It's the same thing as EMS, being calm and being able to relax and talk through the process. We give the owners this is what's happening. We're going to take our time. A lot of owners think that us taking our time isn't urgent, but taking your time, relaxing, and making sure that the dog is not paralyzed or anything like that is what we try to make sure the owners understand.
Okay.
And a lot of times it's assess the situation first before you do anything.
Okay.
And a lot of times it's just talking to them and knowing that they're going to be okay, even though sometimes you know it's not.
Yeah.
So if there's a pet emergency, the number one thing is to force yourself to be calm, speak calmly, soothe the animal, and ears will be on
the way.
Definitely
get us on the call first. Call for help first,
Fantastic. Once again, if you're experiencing an animal emergency anywhere in Connecticut, EARS, the Emergency Animal Response Service, is ready for you. Their emergency contact number is 203-247-0310. If you'd like to learn more about them, it's EARSCT.org. The Emergency Animal Response Service is available and a nonprofit organization working on behalf of all pet owners and pet lovers in Connecticut. If you'd like to help them out with a donation or some underwriting or find out other ways to get involved, I'm sure they'd be glad to hear from you. Just check them out at EARSCT.org to get in touch. And once again, if you're faced with an animal emergency, give EARS a call at 203-247-0310. We want to thank John Nowinski, the founder of the organization, as well as Bree Oleander, a primary responder and technician, and John Santori, who's also a responder and exotics expert. Thank you guys for being on the program.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voket@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheelers Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voket, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.